Okay, this is part two here. I'm going to talk about respiration disease. First, we're going to think of a little respiration video. So, I'll stop this a second. Okay, that's a video on respiration. And now let's get into some respiration. Presentation. Which is now uploaded. Okay? And I'm sorry if it wasn't. Let's see. Gas exchange. Because what we're talking about here is exchanging gases, aren't we? So when there are pathological conditions with gas exchange, that's what we're going to address right now. And what you're going to see in your patients. So we can have chronic inflammatory disorders of the airways, all right, such as asthma. Is that our first one? Yeah. Asthma. Yes. And I know you don't have this. Unfortunately, I loaded the other one twice, and I was just told, and it's on, if you can get it now, I uploaded it. So if those of you who have your laptops, it's available right in a second. I just made that change. I loaded the other one twice and neglected this one. It should be up for you now. And those of you who don't, that's great. You'll just pick it up when you go home. So a chronic inflammation disorder of the airway, such as asthma, can be fatal. You missed my really fun music video with the asthma attack, all right? There are probably some asthma sufferers here. Yes, I'm hoping. Yes, great. Tell us about your asthma. If you're comfortable. Uh-huh. And what does it feel like? Yeah, and you get lightheaded because, obviously, no oxygen to your brain, right? Yes. And so the trigger for you is seasonal allergies. Okay. And so then what happens physiologically or pathophys? Yeah, your bronchi swell, therefore not allowing air to get into your lungs, right? Hence, now we have a problem of gas exchange. If she doesn't have enough air getting into the lungs, lightheadedness, right? And actually, it can be fatal. Acute asthma attacks can be fatal. So your solution to this is inhaler, which is what? What's the med, do you know? It's a steroid. Mm-hmm. It's a steroid that fights the inflammation of the tissues, right? Immediately shrinks them back. Okay. Any other asthmatics? Yes.
John. I have exercise in the so I used to do it driving on playing sports. More so like aerobic ones like basketball or football. Baseball isn't bad, but yeah, I get it when I practice or games, stuff like that.
And tell us how it feels.
Yeah, it's kind of
scary.
It's like you get kind of lightheaded. It's like you feel like you're breathing, but you don't feel like you're really getting anything out of it.
So well, that's right. You're gasping.
It's kind of like breathing through a straw.
Because mm-hmm. It's that normally you have this much to breathe through. Now you have a little tiny bit.
Yeah, and then I have an albuterol inhaler that I
used to use. Yeah, and the albuterol then. Immediately causes the tissues to shrink back, and therefore the airway is now expanded, and you can get the area. Okay. So, yeah, asthma can be seasonal, can be triggered by seasonal allergies, it can be triggered by exercise. What else? You missed my cool video, but she was talking about that it gives her an asthma attack. It's an emotional upset. Okay. I get son-in-law induced asthma. I cannot make it through a meal without having my inhaler. You laugh, it's true! The emotional upset can bring on asthma. But yeah, emotional upset. So lots of different triggers for people whose bodies tend to react in this way. For John, it's the stress of the exercise. Brings it on. For you, it's the pollen in the air. That's how your body reacts. It closes off. It's not going to let any of those pollens in, right? Great. Fine. It's going to kill you in the meantime. Okay. Children, a lot of childhood asthma. I know that you'll talk about this in pediatrics. It's the most common chronic childhood disease is asthma. There is adult onset. Did you have yours as a child, John?
Yeah, like high school as a child.
So you've always had? It's commonly diagnosed in childhood. Sometimes people outgrow it. Other times it's adult onset, a new environment, new pollutants you can respond to, the environment. Triggers, generally there's some kind of a trigger. Allergens, respiratory tract infections. There's post-respiratory tract infection asthma. That's very common too. Someone can have asthma as a result of, it can be secondary to a respiratory tract infection. Exercise, as we talked about. Inhaled irritants. Yeah, your bronchi can react. Some of you inhale, swell up. That would give you an asthma attack. And emotional upset as my son-in-law-induced asthma. Secondhand smoke, medications, and then there can be an early and late response. Sometimes an asthmatic can be, I don't know if you two have had this experience, but the exposure, and then it's a delayed response. The exercise wouldn't do it, but have you ever had that with your allergens? You're fine during the day walking around, then at night, then it hits you? Because you've built up all the... Okay. But sometimes there's a late response. This can happen too. So don't think that there's an immediate. You breathe it in. Not always. Sometimes the body takes a while to react. So inflammatory mediators are released. Activation of inflammatory cells. Bronchoconstriction. Airway edema. Impaired mucociliary clearance. All right. The work of breathing increases. It's hard to breathe. Trapping of air impairs gas exchange. So what do you get? When it's a trapping of air that's impaired gas exchange, you're getting that chronic, that classic presentation of wheezing. Do you wheeze, John? Is that? Yeah. Then you start wheezing, and then you know you better get your inhaler, right? Pretty classic. Chest tightness, coughing, wheezing, dyspnea, tachycardia, obviously. Compensatory mechanism, right? Fatigue, apprehension, it's scary. Asthmatics get pretty scary. Respiratory breath sounds can improve right after failure. So you can easily take Albuterol and come back quickly, right? Yeah, you can respond quickly and go out and play the game or continue running or whatever. Generally, yeah. The meds work really fast. Is the presentation always wheezing? No, can be cough, virulent asthma. Commonly seen, like say if someone has a bad bronchitis for a while, they're getting over it. They may have that cough that now is asthmatic. So be aware of what's going on. Status atelectasis with severe asthma does not respond to treatment. People still do die of asthma, which is very frightening. It's going to be taken very seriously. An epinephrine pin is something that's common in most first aid kits. That epinephrine is going to do what? It's going to immediately have the tissues reduce and therefore allow the air to get in. COPD, chronic airflow obstruction, chronic bronchitis, emphysema are COPDs. Generally, it's slow and progressive. You see the COPDs commercials on TV, right? With all sorts of meds. Resistance to airflow is increased. Expiration becomes difficult or slow. There's a mismatch between the alveoli ventilation and the perfusion. There's not enough ventilation. And you have impaired, the result is impaired gas exchange. Chronic bronchitis. Bronchitis, we talked about it being an acute disease when we talked about ventilation problems. But respiration, it turns into a respiration problem when it's chronic. Because people are chronically without air from the bronchitis, without sufficient oxygen. You end up with narrowing of the airways, the most commonly reoccurring infection, inhaled irritants, and thick mucus. Emphysema. Anybody? You know anybody with emphysema or had patients yet? You must have patients. No? You have emphysema? Yeah. Does it say what it is? Yeah. Emphysema is just one of the COPDs. In this disease, we have destruction of the walls of the alveoli, enlargement of the abnormal airspace, the airway collapse. So you don't have as much alveolar surface as for the gas. So these are your people that are often on oxygen. We're giving them oxygen therapy in the hospitals, aren't we? Or they're carrying their oxygen tanks around. Right. What's going on out there? Having a good time? So COPD in general, we have a 0 to 4 classification for this group of diseases. You can have a morning cough, dyspnea with activity. Now, a barrel chest. What? This is common. Why do you see a barrel? Have you seen that? COPD people? Again, I picture the old white man smoking, you know, mid-60s. I like this room because it's better than a lung. They're a little better. Okay. Barrel chest, right? Because you see this in children with asthmatic children. You see it in COPD victims. People are continually pressing their breathing against the side. So the muscles actually expand. You get a larger barrel chest because the tissue expands trying to get the air in. You use more muscles and you get a more expansive chest. And again, I picture the white smoker, you know, 60-something, with his big chest with probably some ascites. He's this classic who's having trouble breathing, probably on oxygen, your classic COPD person. A lot of mucus, cyanosis. Generally, often there's some evidence of right-side heart failure. Emphysema, we see this barrel chest, okay. Let's see, what else? Cystic fibrosis. You're going to study this when you get into peds. Cystic fibrosis is autosomal recessive disorder, so it is genetic. People are born with it. They have it for life. The disease can be treated, although they have the disorder. People used to not live into their reproductive years with cystic fibrosis. But our treatment has gotten so good that people do. Treated a man in his 50s that was a cystic fibrosis patient, but extremely unusual. The deal with cystic fibrosis is mucus. The body creates amazing amounts of mucus, resulting in having a lot of difficulty breathing and expanding the lungs. It's quite interesting. They eventually die. They have right-sided hypertrophy of the heart, and then the lung, they die of cold pneumonia. Generally have right side heart failure, generally is what kills them. A lot of mucus, so when you go into the hospitals and see children with cystic fibrosis, these are the children that keep coming back to the hospital. They know the staff, they keep coming in, and they're coming in for pulmonary treatments, respiratory treatments, and then they often come in every few months, and they stay for a week and have their treatment in a week. It's quite interesting. I hope you have the opportunity to see it. But remember, it's a genetic disease. The other thing that these people manifest is a lack of a digestive enzyme. So as nurses, all we're doing really is facilitating the respiratory treatments and giving digestive enzymes. So you may see CF patients more and more in your practices because they're living longer. And we're seeing adults now with COPD, with cystic fibrosis in practice. They have, obviously, lots of complications as they age, which makes sense. History, lung disease, barrel chest. Bronchiolectasis is a dilation of one or more of the bronchi, abnormal dilation, cough, sputum, okay? And there are all sorts of occupational lung diseases, right? Pneumonia. There can be miners' diseases with the lungs, breathing different things that are problematic. Asbestos. Silicosis, silicone, coal miners, black lungs. And that's about all I wanted to talk about, except for pulmonary embolism. We've talked a lot about embolisms, so you're clear on that, right? An embolism can move to the lungs. And what are going to be the immediate presentation? What are you going to see in your patient? What? Cyanosis? Yes, but not initially. So it's a breath and pain. Yeah. And then, of course, as it progresses, they're going to be cyanotic. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, you know about that. What else do I want to do here? I think that's about it. So you're taking pulse oxes on patients, aren't you? Okay, be aware that anything under... When do we start getting worried? Under 90, you start being aware, right? If they're falling below 80, you're getting into the ICU. If they're like 50 or 60, there's a good chance of death. If you're down to 30, they're you're hoping they're not. Okay. So that's why the pulse oxes are important, particularly with someone with COPDs. You want to take those readings and see how they're doing. Do they need some more oxygen? Do you need to turn it up? Do you need to turn it down? So the pulse ox is a wonderful little machine that you should really think about when you're using it. What's going on? What's really happening here? Sometimes you can just say, why don't we get you up in the chair and take some more deep breaths? It can be as simple as that. If they're standing at 92, 90. I'm going to breathe a little deeper. I'm going to breathe, oh yeah. Now, let's do your incisus broader a little bit. So remember to fill your lungs. Okay, because you may have a little old lady that has pneumonia that's breathing shallowly at 87. All she needs to do is remember to breathe a little more and oxygenate. So it's an important tool for your practice. In COPD, you're going to see oxygen levels drop. So these people are on oxygen, failure of oxygenation. You know that, hypoxemia, right? You've got oxygen, and then you're going to see the carbon dioxide levels rise, right? And then you get hypoventilation. Let's see, what else? Acute respiratory failure, primarily it's right-sided. I don't know if there's anything else I want to talk about here. Hold on. Okay, good. I'm sure you're all anxious to review some of this material, right? Yeah.
With the COPD patients I've had.
Yeah, good. Tell us about them.
You just have to be careful with having your oxygen picture CO2 retainer.
Can you explain that?
Because if you... Sometimes people function at a level of 88% to 92%.
So if they're chronic.
Yeah. And if you put their oxygen to compensate and give them about 95%, you might kill them.
Wow.
Because their body has adapted to that O2 range already for so long. And then if you turn on oxygen, it's going to basically kill their response of breathing.
Right.
On their own.
They don't think they need to breathe. Their bodies don't think they need to breathe if they're at 85 because they've been so accustomed as a result of the COPD to having their levels at about 88. So you will suppress the response to breathe. Thank you. Excellent. Yeah. So be careful with your COPD patients in practice that you're not bringing. Maybe 88 is normal, even though in general we say that would be something you would be concerned about. Granted, we would be because it's a COPD patient. But nonetheless, your treatment is not going to be to turn up that oxygen to 6 or 7 liters. Because at 2 liters, they're on 88, right? And if you bring it up to 5 liters, bring up their oxygen to 95%, for instance, they're going to stop you. Because their body doesn't even need any. Got it? So thank you. Important point of practice. Any other things to mention about your intimacy of the patients? Watch respiratory disorders in practice. They're fascinating. Not a heck of a lot for a nurse to do, but be vigilant. Watch. Monitor. look at the oxygen. Can we give oxygen without an order and when it's an emergency? Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, we can. General long-term oxygen treatment, of course, is a physician order. But if there's an emergency, you can give oxygen. You would be remiss in not doing so. Mm-hmm. Right. There's some problems with gas exchange. Anything else on this topic? Obviously, dyspnea, pain, shortened breath sounds dull. Okay, now we're doing this exam review, pulling up some objectives here. These brilliant people in this morning class decided that that should be recorded as well. Diabetes, week 6. I really want you, I'll just talk in general. Prevalence and incidence, you just know it happens a lot. The pathophys, I want you to realize what we're doing. We're balancing two things in the blood. What is it? Right, period, that's it. If you can grasp that concept, you have diabetes. All right? That's all we're doing. And so what does a diabetic have? Or not have in this case, yeah. Does it make enough insulin, right? Okay, so if it doesn't make enough, if a diabetic doesn't make enough insulin, what's happening with the sugars? They're going up. Very simple. Keep that balance. That's it. And so we give different kinds of insulins, don't we? Okay. I want you to know that there are differences. I want you to know that there are long-acting, short-acting, intermediate-acting. I will give you, if I say Lispro, I will say a short-acting insulin. Okay? So I don't expect you to know the names of them. But I expect you to know when you would give a long-acting versus when you would give a short-acting. But I'm not going to have you responsible for those names because those are going to change what hospital you're in, what you're dealing with. So, no. But do know what they do. Okay, you know the pathophys. Risk factors? Who has type 2 diabetes? You got it. You know that. What are the manifestations of diabetes? That is hyperglycemia. Hypoglycemia. Polyuria, right? Lack of energy, the keys. Okay. All right. Let's see. Treatment. When we give, there are insulins, oral insulins as well, right? Hypoglycemics, correct? Yeah. As well as injectable insulins. What's the largest side effect? What's the thing we're most concerned about? Hypoglycemia. And, Victoria, what is the little ditty about that? Right. Cold and clammy, need some candy would be a symptom of hypoglycemia. And so your normal glucose reading is right around 100, right? When does someone become hypoglycemic? 60. 60 and under generally is the time we kick in that hypoglycemic protocol, all right? And then what are we going to give? Some form of sugar. Whether your hospital says inject them with sugar there's depending on how low it is, we do different things. We may hang a dextrose strip. We may shoot them with glucagon. We may have them drink orange juice, depending on what's going on and how severe. All right, let's see. Implications for insulin and hypoglycemic agents, we pretty much discussed this, right? The biggest problem would be giving too much insulin. And can you think of a time that may happen? When you were, you did everything right, and when would that happen? Your patient. Yeah. Perfect time, yeah. You give them before dinner, the tray comes, and all of a sudden they're nauseous. And you know how to give insulin. You've all done it, or the majority of you have done it, right? It's not you've watched and understand and seen it in a MR. In general, they do this really weird thing where they have a baseline. So someone may have a baseline of 3 units of Lispro, and then we add or subtract. The sliding scale is add or subtract. That's a little weird. Most hospitals just have the basic sliding scale. It's probably what you've seen, right? You've all seen a sliding scale. So the management of diabetes is left up to who? Absolutely. It's a large part of our med-surg practices, as you're learning, right? It's a large part. A lot of people with diabetes, we handle it, don't we? We manage it. So this is an area, unlike some of these heart and respiratory diseases that we've been talking about, diabetes is something that we very much have a hand in the treatment. Very much, we're very involved. As well as the education, right? Okay. All right. So, education brings us to the self-care practices. What's important? What are you going to teach a diabetic as far as their insulin control? What would be important in a...
Testing,
yeah. Diet, absolutely. What else? Exercise, yeah. What's exercise going to do to the glucose in the body? Use it. So if you're exercising, do you need more or less insulin?
Less.
You need to take in less. You need to have less than your injection. Give less insulin. Because the body's using up the sugar, right, through the exercise. And remember, what do you give the insulin for? You use up sugar. So you need less insulin. Got it? Okay. Yeah. So that's this whole thing, this whole remember the balance. Just bring in all these little factors. Think about all these factors. If you can keep in your mind that diabetes is all about the balance, you should get every single question right. Okay? Because that's the main thing. And if you think through exercise, oh yeah, what does exercise do? It uses sugar. Okay. What does insulin do? It uses sugar. Oh, that's right. So if someone's exercising, they don't need as much insulin because the exercise is using the sugar, right? I mean, that's the kind of logical progression I want you to be able to do.
So is that why I got a friend with diabetic who puts all together, she would, in the game, feel really low, and
she'd take sugar tabs. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Because she probably took her normal amount of insulin, yet she's using up the sugar, and so she's becoming hypoglycemic. Not enough sugar, so now she's got to go and take some more sugar so that she can keep a balance. Exactly. So think about your friend with exercise. That's a perfect example. All right, let's see. That's self-care practices. All right. We talked about hypoglycemics. Any more questions on diabetes? That's my understanding. I've never given an injection with a pin. But that's I've seen nurses do it and talk to nurses about it, and that's my understanding. I think it's coming. Not yet. No, I've never given injections, but I think it's going to become more common. I think that diabetics will be using the pins themselves because they're much easier to use than drawing up insulin, and there's less chance of error. Right? So I think pins are certainly something that's been around for a while. We're seeing them more in hospitals, and I predict we're going to see them. And yes, that's my understanding too. Hold it.
Yeah. So what's the difference with the pin?
What's the difference with the pin?
It's already in, and you just have to, there's like an adjustment.
You don't have to drop the insulin.
Yeah,
which is very cool. Just put the needle in and stick it. So it's much safer. You just dial the right amount rather than pulling it up and looking and making sure you're right at the little line. And remember, there are times where you're going to get a long-acting insulin and a short-acting, right? You've got all that sorted out. Yes? Got that? Any more questions on diabetes?
What would you do
Victoria, when would you give a long acting?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a long period of time?
Sure.
Exactly. Exactly.
Is that about it? Like saying they're going somewhere and they're not going to be available to do their interviews, that they give themselves a long acting period?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really long.
For instance, my patient that I've been telling you about this semester, he was refusing any sticks, any glucose sticks. I remember we're at home, so he's the boss, so we didn't push him. I mean, so I asked the physician for an order for some Lantus. Can we just give him some long-acting insulin that we can stop sticking him? This is at the very end of his life. You know, because we didn't want to disturb him, we didn't want to stick him, but I wanted to maintain some control over the glucose levels. And they were consistently 200, 220 in the mornings. And I'm saying, let's just do some Lantus, let us treat him all day and stop sticking him during his last week of life. It didn't make any sense. So that's exactly what we did. But yeah, if you're going on a long car trip or something, or you know, on an airplane or whatever, didn't want to deal with it, I'm sure they could do the same kind of thing. You'd, of course, have to think about meals, have to think about exercise, you know. You'd have to keep all those things in mind. But like now, when we fly, they don't give you food anyway, right? I mean, I do. I fly all the way to Boston and starve to death. So, yeah, that might be just fine. It's a good question. Anything else about... You got this. Okay, this is an important part of practice, an important part of this course. It's not complicated. Just this. Balance. You have that concept and you should be able to think through every single question. Okay. All right. Cardiovascular and lymphatic system, we have two systems, right? That's all. Okay. Why does the heart beat? Is the heart going to beat without electrical stimulation? What can disrupt that electrical stimulation? Mm-hmm. Result of trauma, which might be what? What's going to upset the electrical stimulation of the heart? Let's say there's not a problem getting it there. There's a problem with the conduction of the electronic signals within the heart itself. When might you see that? Pardon me?
AFib?
Possibly, yeah. Possibly with AFib, yeah. Okay, some problem in the pulsing. That would be a result of the electrical disturbance not being conducted well within the heart. Okay, good, that's true. How about if someone has an ischemic area of the heart left over from a mild heart attack? So what's going to happen in that area? It's not going to respond. That could be a problem. Let's say someone has an MI and they survive, a mild cardiac infarction, where the blood supply is cut off from part of the heart. You have part of the heart becomes ischemic. Okay? So then the electrical conduction in that area doesn't happen. So that's going to greatly affect the ability of the heart to beat correctly, isn't it? If you have an ischemic part of the heart that's not getting the signals. Right? Then we might do a pacemaker. Or with the AFib, we might do an implantable defibrillator. Remember the defibrillators you learned about in your CPR class? What do they do? Stop the heart. What's the purpose? Get it. Because if it's beating like this, it can be a problem. Okay, so think about coronary circulation, the electrical properties of the heart tissue. So remember that the heart has large vessels running through it. We think about that all the time, right? It has large vessels running through it that are pumping the oxygenated blood all over the body. But remember that the heart itself has to survive and be healthy. If has to conduct electricity in order to pump regularly. It needs to be vascularized, just like any other tissue. It needs to have oxygen. And Victoria had a question.
How do the defibrillators and the pacemakers work together?
I don't know the details of how they work. I know what they each do. So the pacemaker is going to set a pulse. The defibrillator, let's say someone's going like this. The defibrillator is going to stop the heart and hope. And then if you have both of them, then the pacemaker is going to start it.
Okay, so it'll restart.
It'll restart the heart. So I guess to answer your question, that's how they would work together. And there are people that have both. Yeah, there you go. Okay. But I don't know of one machine that does both, if that was your question. She has one machine that does both?
Yeah.
Cool.
Is it
the defibrillator? All right. I'm not a cardiac nurse. Good for your brain. But that's what's going on. Okay. Stops it and then gets the pulse back. Steady again. Okay. So that's about the electrical responses. You got that. You have the concept that the heart is unto itself. Nurses, what are we looking at with cardiac patients? What are some of your diagnoses? Cardiac output, yeah. It's low. And how's that going to affect the body? Yeah, lack of oxygen. All sorts of problems, right? Mm-hmm, yeah, you could. All right. Diagnostic tests. The only thing I really want you to know is there's a couple of tests for that we do after MIs. Some of those enzyme tests that we talked about. The CKMP. Remember? There's some enzyme tests that we do after an MI, and you'll see these on the cardiac floor. The idea is that the heart secretes enzymes after an MI, so they're going to show later, and that's the only point I want you to know, that there are enzymes that we can test for that will show if a person has had a myocardial infarction, because the tissues give off these enzymes as they die or as in some time. 8 to 24 hours afterwards, you're going to see them. And you may see these. Talked about those, and I know they're in your notes. What else? What are you doing with your people with cardiac disease? Yeah, you're concerned about perfusion. Because you're concerned about perfusion, what are you seeing in them? Fatigue, right? Lack of oxygenation. What were you saying? Yes, absolutely, edema. Okay, so you're treating all that. Yes, sure. We sure can. We give meds, right? What kind of cardiac meds are we giving? What kind of cardiac meds are you giving? What are you treating? Digoxin. What does digoxin do? Yeah, opens up the vessels big time, right? And allows for oxygenation by dilating the vessels. Good drugs for hypertension. We talked about nitroglycerin, TAPs. Okay, so you know about nitro, right? Mm-hmm. And we give it for angina. Mm-hmm. Okay. You know what angina is? Mm-hmm. And the manifestation? Chest pain. Depending on what kind of, I'm not going to ask you to break down the different kinds of angina. But just know that there are more serious kinds that lead to, that are precursors to heart attacks. Others that aren't. And yes, pain. And you know what's going on with a heart attack? The heart muscle is not getting oxygenated, right? Therefore, you have pain and all those other manifestations, right? Okay. We're not going to talk about hemodynamic monitoring. It's more of an advanced kind of thing. All right. So the vessels can have problems too. We talked about the heart as a muscle, then we moved into talking about the vessels within the heart, didn't we? We talked about the tissues of the heart itself, angina, myocardial infarctions, all are having to do with the tissue of the heart, the electronic problems, problems with the AFib, for example. Okay? With how the heart is beating. That all has to do with the tissues of the heart, right? The heart itself as a functioning organ. We also have these big vessels that go all over the body. They go go through the heart and pump throughout the body, right? But there can be problems with that vascularization, can't there? What are some of the problems that we're going to see from the vessels? Yeah, atherosclerosis, right? Which is what? Plaque, what does it do? All right, it can include, right? Include the arteries. Right. Make them hard. It's build up a plaque. What has been linked to these plaque, this plaque buildup? Yeah, sure, diabetes, because you're going to have some vascular constriction. What else?
Diet,
yeah, specifically, what are we talking about? Hypercholesterolemia, which simply means high cholesterol in the blood, specifically triglycerides, right? Fats in the blood and how people metabolize them. So people can be predisposed to some of these vascular problems. Okay? All right. So what are their risk factors? Genetic predisposition and how you metabolize triglycerides, right? What else? Diabetes, someone said yes. What else? Two big ones. You said that?
Diet.
Diet, yeah. Diet and one other exercise. What about lymph? A whole separate circulatory system. What's the purpose?
Waste.
Waste and okay. So if the lymph system is a problem or not functioning well, you're not going to be able to fight the infection as well, huh? Immunosuppressed, not from a cellular viewpoint, but from a mechanical transportation viewpoint, right? Causation. And you have lymph nodes. And we talked about infection and spleen and everything plays a part there. Okay, let's see. We talked about blood, and we talked about some of the vascular problems. We talked about people not having enough or inadequate amounts of red blood cells. What's that called? Anemia. And there's some different causes, right? And it's often primary, isn't it? As is hypertension. Hypertension can be secondary or primary. Secondary meaning it can be a result of something else, say atherosclerosis. But it's often primary of unknown cause. It's not something directly related. Same with anemia. And so when you, ideally, yeah, I mean, sure, when you do your write-ups and someone has a low hematocrit and hemoglobin, and you can differentiate between those, right? Do you know the difference between hematocrit and hemoglobin? Generally, they're together, but not always. There are times when there are plenty of red blood cells, so the hematocrit's going to be fine. And the hemoglobin is not. When would that be? Can you give me an example? Of a kind of anemia. No, because they're... That's a decline in red blood cell numbers, so the hematocrit and the hemoglobin are both of them. Something that we looked at, something that we studied that you know about, where the hematocrit is going to be fine, the hemoglobin is going to be low. Yeah. Why? Why sickle cell? Why is the hematocrit going to be fine? The hemoglobin is going to be low. If you know this concept, you can probably apply it to just about everything dealing with red blood cells. Yeah. Right. There's plenty of red blood cells, but they can't carry oxygen, so they can't become hemoglobin. Therefore, the hemoglobin counts low, the oxygen carrying capacity of the red blood cell, right? But we've got plenty of red blood cells. So what are going to be the manifestations of any kind of anemia?
Fatigue,
right. Why? Not getting enough oxygen. What's not getting enough oxygen? The body, the brain, the cells, the tissues. Now with sickle cell anemia, we get clumping in the vascular system. What does that lead to? Occluded, right? Okay. Or semi-occluded. It's not completely, it wasn't being gynous and done. But there's some occlusion, right, from the clumping. How's that going to manifest in your patient? Right. Why? Keep talking. You got it. Can you say that whole thing loudly so your classmates can hear that whole progression?
Their tissues become
ischemic.
Ischemic.
Good. You got it. She's been reading. Ischemic, yeah.
Which
they're trying to build up a
lactic acid.
In the cells, why? And so the respiration is now anaerobic. Right? So it'll switch to anaerobic respiration. And then they secrete lactic acid, causing pain. Same thing if you're running and your muscles deprived of oxygen and you get it. Same if you have a heart attack. Alright? And you can't get, part of the heart can't be oxygenated. Okay. That pain is the same pain. What's the treatment? Oxygen. And that's it. Yes. You know, I don't know. It certainly makes sense, wouldn't it? Yeah, and a lot of hydration. Okay, so you're giving your patient anticoagulants, right? Let's talk about that. Brings us right into our anticoagulant discussion. I want you to know about anticoagulants, because they're very much nursing. Why do you give your patient anticoagulants? Why are they susceptible to blood clots? What's this? This is a triangle. Virchow's triangle, right? What are the 3 points of Virchow's triangle? Some injury, yeah. Some vascular injury. Hemostasis, vascular injury, what's the thing? Okay, you'll know by next week. We'll have it all down. Okay, so that's what we're fighting against when we're we don't want those states to have hypercoagulability. We don't want those states to happen. And so we treat that, don't we? So it won't. We give them anticoagulants. What else we do as nurses? We You ambulate them, yeah. Absolutely. Why is that important? Right. Improve circulation. Just up walking around. It's amazing what a difference. It's a simple, even, you know, just getting out of bed, walking a little bit. It not only helps the vasculature, it helps the lungs a lot. If you can breathe, you breathe so much better if you're upright than if you're in bed. So think about that when you have your respiratory patients. Up and around is really important. And whose responsibility is that? Us. Whose responsibility is it is all the whole thing to not have thrombi? It's our responsibility, isn't it? Very much so. What's vitamin K going to do? How does that feel? How does that, what does that look like? It's a coagulant, not an antibiotic. So think about your patient going to surgery. How does that factor in? Why is that a problem? Or could it be a potential problem? If we're treating them for anticoagulants. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bleed out. Because what are we doing? We're extending the clotting time with the anticoagulants. We're extending the time it takes for the blood to clot. Your PTs, your prothrombin, it's a problem time to bleed. Yeah, vitamin K is a clotting agent. So someone's having problems clotting, we can give them vitamin K. We give it to babies to make sure. Yeah, with shots. Or we can hang it. But generally, it's an injection. Yeah. To increase their clotting factor. I'm not sure what babies tend to be. Don't clot enough. I'm not really sure. But ask that from Dr. Leroy Palmer. We had with the bees. Yeah. Yes. People with hemophilia. What's going on there? They have deficiencies in their clotting factor, the clotting cascade. There's something missing. I honestly don't know the chemistry and how the vitamin K works. On a cursory level, I would say yes, but I think it would depend on the cellular mechanics and exactly what is going on. I don't want to say yeah for sure.
So they're not working for 12
weeks? No, not for 12 weeks. There's no treatment for them. And I don't know if I'm looking at a factor. I'm kind of thinking no, because they don't have it. But I don't know the cellular mechanics that well. Okay, but yeah, that's what hemophilia is, right? And we have people that clot too much. That's a problem too. Hypercoagulability. What about vascularization? You know how a problem with arteries present and how a problem with vein presents, right? Remember that little square, this one?
This is the kind of thing again. If you haven't picked it up, do. You may see it. Remember this little exercise? Is this person presenting with a vascular problem or... Oh, not this one. This is the early stage of the late stage of the hypoxia. There's another one that looked like that. It had to do with... Here, this one. Arteries and veins. You should pick up this. You see something. You will also see your hypoxia. Early and late hypoxia. Okay. That's all pretty logical. You should have it. All having to do with vascularization, oxygenation, and quality. Okay. And we play with that with drugs.
Okay. And you're going to be able to tell me how if it's a vascular problem or if it's a venous problem and how that presents. We know the difference between veins and arteries. Right? And what kind of person is going to be someone with a vascular disorder? What patient population? I mean, peripheral vascular disorder. What would be it? Yeah, diabetics, a lot of problems. Also, they have peripheral neuropathy, right? But that inability to move oxygen throughout the body ends up to be a real problem. The ultimate problem being what? I mean, what's the ultimate result of that? What do they have? They have amputations. from that extremely pro-vascularization. Okay. All right. Talked a little bit about bleeding disorders, treatments, patho. You got this? And vascularization. Okay? Sounding good so far? Does this help? Okay. Anything? Any questions about what we've talked about so far? You have those basic concepts. Basic concepts meaning insulin and blood. Between veins and arteries. The heart as a muscle. And the different thing is it conducts electricity and the need for that. Okay. Why it pumps. Oh, collateral circulation. You know what that is, right? Collateral circulation, what does that mean? Commonly happens in the heart, can happen anywhere. When there's a deficit in a main vessel, the other tributaries, the other vessels around it are going to take up the slack, which is why someone with coronary artery disease can have a 90% occlusion and not be symptomatic. So if I asked you on a test question, would be perfect test question would be, why would someone, I describe a person that has 90% occlusion. Why are they asymptomatic? Why? Lateral circulation. So I know what that is. That's real, you see it. All right, upper respiratory infections. Talked about upper respiratory infections last week. The common cold. We talked about secondary infections. You remember the anatomy and what's going on. Risk factors. You know what risk factors are for getting all those upper respiratory infections, don't you? You're experiencing them all right now. Stress, fatigue, poor diets. You know the physio, right? Are we going to give someone presents with a virus? Are we going to start them on antibiotics? Why not? Not a bacterial infection. It's a viral infection. When might we start them on antibiotics? There may be a time when we would. Pardon?
Before surgery?
Sure. Yeah. Let's say someone presented with a cold. You might go ahead and start them on antibiotics. Because why? Yeah, you want to be absolutely sure that there's no infection. But let's move away from that, because that would be an odd kind of thing. You're right, but I thought I was going. If someone is very immunosuppressed, and you know for darn sure they're going to get a secondary bacterial infection, then you might not wait. And this person's had pneumonia 3 times already this year, and they're 90 years old. Okay, they present with a cold. It feels probably viral, but darn it, this person is definitely going to move into a bacteria. Let's go ahead and strengthen their immune system with some with an antibiotic right away. That might be a time, but in general, with a healthy population, you're getting what happens? How do we treat viruses, which are colds, upper respiratory infection? Just run their course. Just allow them to run their course. And don't treat them. But there are complications, right? And often these are bacterial infections that we can treat. And we talked about laryngitis, we talked about bronchitis, right? Acute bronchitis, versus today we talked about chronic bronchitis as a COPD. Acute bronchitis would be a complication, could be a complication from a cold. Could also be a community acquired. Okay, got that? And so the respiratory system is pretty easy. Infections just go down. Right? It starts as a cold, and then if it gets worse, it can just progress. Or you can have primary laryngitis, for instance. It doesn't have to be. Okay, You know about the risk factors, you know about healthy lifestyle, correct? You know about medications, when you give, you're going to give lots of fluids. Rest, you know that. Okay, those are upper respiratory disorders. Let's do ventilatory disorders that we talked about today. We talked about trauma, we talked about broken ribs, we talked about basically how the whole breathing takes place. What's going to happen if somebody punctures a diaphragm in trauma? It's going to be a problem, huh? They can't ventilate. They can certainly respire. Well, no, they can't even do that, because if ventilation doesn't happen, what's going to happen to respiration? Can't. You can't have respiration without ventilation. Yeah, you know. Yeah, a lot of oxygen. Probably go to surgery. And fix it. Okay. And great, you brought up the wonderful thing about over-oxygenating a COPD patient. That was good. And we talked a little bit about asthmatics. We talked about some of the medications in the large airways. Correct? We talked about a pulmonary, talked about pulmonary edema. We talked about pulmonary thrombi, how that's going to, talked about gas exchange. What else about this? Risk factors. Okay. Anything else on content? What I have now for you that I'd like to give you is just some practice sentence questions to play with. Does that sound like a good plan? For points. 4 points. Yes, 4 points. Okay. Okay, let me turn off GarageBand and have it start turning into, yay, you're working. I'm so proud of you. GarageBand, we're going to stop you and turn you into... Stop recording.